Support for Boston Public Radio comes from New England Recovery Center, providing inpatient addiction treatment in state-of-the-art facilities located in Westboro, Mass. All major insurance plans accepted. Learn more at newenglandrecoverycenter.org.
Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Hello, Jim.
Hello, Marjorie. So in the latest series of encouraging results from vaccine developers comes AstraZeneca's, which is reportedly inexpensive, easy to produce, and effective. But are we mistaking this long-term solution as a cure for our immediate and colossal coronavirus problems? Join us on line for his take on this and our other medical headlines is Art Kaplan. Art is a doctor, William F. and Virginia Connolly Mitty Chair and Director of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU School of Medicine. Hello there, Art Kaplan.
Hello. Art's talking today in a world of next-door leaf blowers. Sorry.
Oh, really?
Don't they drive you nuts? I mean, somebody's going to invent the silent leaf blower. That would be, they could go right to the moon.
Why don't you go do what Rand Paul's neighbor did to him? No, actually, that was a joke, by the way. Don't send any angry emails.
Have a confrontation by the fence line. Yeah.
Exactly.
So, Art Kaplan, let's get back to, we're seemingly swimming now in vaccines with great effectiveness. Give us the deal on the AstraZeneca vaccine.
Looks good. This is a more traditional vaccine, meaning it has a virus that deactivated that triggers a response. They had an accident in their study. They wound up misdosing the first dose and underdosed it and then gave a second one, and it turned out that was more efficacious. They think that's because people might have built up a kind of reaction to the first dose that was too strong and weakened the second dose. So they got a number out of that subgroup that looks like 90%, kind of like the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines. Average response was 70% with the two regular doses, so I assume they'll be adjusting that. Anyway, we now have at least three, and I'm expecting even more to come through the pipeline in the next couple of months.
And by the way, normal refrigeration, that's one of the big appeals here, as opposed to Pfizer, which is absurdly cold, and Moderna, which is relatively cold. This is just a normal refrigerated vaccine, theoretically, right?
We can call this the Goldilocks phenomena. So you got real cold, kind of cold, and just right. And the AstraZeneca one then has the promise of being able to get to places that the high refrigeration ones won't, including, you know, poor parts of the world as well as rural America, let's say.
I have a couple of more questions about the AstraZeneca thing. I didn't know till you just said it, and I thought I had read everything. This half-dose thing, which gets it up to 90%, was a mistake? I mean, it was?
Yep, utter mistake. And it makes you nervous because you're sort of like, what the heck? This trial is... get the best people on it, and what are they doing? But they underdosed the amount in the first vaccine, and then they found this result by accident. So, yeah, it was. It was not intended. Now, again, the numbers who got that are smaller, so they're going to have to run their study, I would say, longer to really be convincing, recruit more folks. But they'll be in for an emergency use request because even with the two full dose thing, they got pretty good results.
And one last question about AstraZeneca is I was hearing in my head, I just started getting confused, so I shut off the TV because it was giving me a headache. Unlike the Pfizer and the Moderna thing, this one theoretically, well, might work on transmission. Is that?
That's what, right. So
and what is that? Can you explain that?
Yeah, the first two vaccines only measured did you get sick, and they actually only measured did you get mild or moderately sick, figuring if that didn't happen, then you weren't going to get seriously ill. And as far as I know from the data on Pfizer and Moderna, they didn't have hospitalizations in the active vaccine arm, so that seems like a pretty safe inference. For the AstraZeneca one, they measured did you infect other people as one of the study points, and that becomes really important because if you just get a vaccine that keeps you going and keeps you out of the hospital, that's great, you're protected, but you still might be able to shed virus and infect other people. I'm not saying you will, they didn't measure it. They went for is this going to keep you alive, is this going to keep you out of the hospital, is their measure. So you know, you don't want to have people get vaccinated and then run out to the airport or run out to the bar and still be transmitting. the AstraZeneca one looks like they measured that a little more and it looked promising.
You know, Art Kaplan, won't one of these emerge as the best and most practical? I mean, you know, a year from now, we'll be giving everybody, you know, with all three of these or 10 of these, however ultimately emerge, mm-hmm. still be around. It would seem to me that the Pfizer one could be short-lived because of the refrigeration problems.
But they need billions, yeah. Marjorie, billions. That's
they do. They do need billions, but that's what I'm wondering. Do they just keep going for a while and one emerges as the winner or what?
I think they keep going for a while, and way down the road, one emerges as the winner. There's enough need right now that they're going to have a market for all of them, and I think you'll see the Pfizer one probably in the big cities where the refrigerator is, the Moderna one a little bit further out into the suburbs, and then our friend AstraZeneca out in the rural areas. AstraZeneca, however, says it can make billions of doses in the coming year of their vaccine easier to manufacture. So, you know, if you were trying to invest in these things, the AstraZeneca one costs, they said, roughly $3-4 a shot.
Mm-hmm.
The Pfizer and the Moderna ones are up at the $25 level. That mm-hmm. really makes a difference,
yeah.
you know, for worldwide distribution, too. So, yeah, I think there'll be winners and losers, but I don't think it's going to be right away because the need is just out there right now to get everything rolling.
We're talking to Art Kaplan, our medical ethicist. So, Art Kaplan, we keep reading and hearing that distributing vaccines within the United States to 300-plus million people is an undertaking unlike anything we've faced before. So what do we know about distribution? Jim has repeatedly and correctly stated we don't know who's first, how it's going to...
Well, we sort of know who's first, but that's
people.
Sort of where it ends. Yeah, yeah. yeah. So what is the deal?
We don't even know what that means, though, do we?
Yeah, exactly.
Does it mean
great point.
Nurses and doctors? Does it mean people that
right.
are in ambulances? Does it mean firefighters?
Yeah.
So when do we find out that? And will we be, are we pipe dreaming? Do you think we're going to be able to distribute 300 million plus vaccines by next summer?
No, one bit of good news is a lot of them are already made and stored because I would be nervous saying, oh, we're going to start right now to make 300 million vaccines. Remember, the government prepaid
yeah.
right.
these companies. Well, if they don't work, we'll throw them out, but we're giving you the money. And so they did manufacture, I don't know, 20 million. You hear those things, 20 million, 30 million doses that are pre-stored in super refrigerators or whatever they require from Moderna and Pfizer. So we have them. There's been a big push to get the armed forces ready to distribute them. To give credit to Donald Trump, he kept saying we're going to use the army to get this stuff out there. We've seen our friend, I think his name is Perna, the general who's in charge of material command, and he's ready to go. And he's got
so he says
he just wants to know where am I shipping. So you know, hopefully that kind of rollout with the trucks and the armed forces delivering will go well. Then they're going to go to the states, and there'll be some formula that each state gets something. I would argue we should do it by where the need is the greatest in terms of flare-ups. Vermont is not the same as, say, North Dakota, to cite two rural places. Some people say, well, the people in North Dakota didn't follow safety procedures
Amen.
As much as those did in Vermont. But, you know, you got to sort of send the vaccine where it's needed. I still would argue we could frown and grimace about it, but I still think you got to do it. So I'm not in favor of distributing by population, but that may be how it goes. And then once the states get it, they'll come up with their rules. And I'll say it's obvious. The first line of people to get it are healthcare workers and people who clean rooms and people who keep the hospital going, because you need a hospital system for the people who are still sick and to get us through this winter. And the healthcare workers need to be protected. So that's first, and that's why we all agree on that. Then I think some states may say they're going to go to nursing homes. Other states may say they're going to go to essential workers. That would be the police and the first responders, people who handle food. It might even be in some states, including teachers. And there's some fighting about that, but I think that's how it'll go next. Essential workers also get more minority people into the loop, and people feel like they've been hit hard, so there are more minority people working in those essential industries. And then you're probably going to the over 65s and the people with conditions that put them at risk, you know, diabetes and asthma and those kinds of things. So I think the rollout isn't going to be the same in every state, but I think that'll be the rough sequence.
You know, I have to say, I still don't get this. First of all, the good news to me and the excitement is building. I know it's going to take months and months for everybody to get it. But the notion that as early as, according to Pfizer, a day or two after the vote on emergency use authorization, which is December 10th, the first vaccines will be administered is just like so exciting, assuming yeah. As long as it doesn't cause people to let their guard down even more than they are letting their yeah. guard down. But I just don't. I saw Bill Gates the other night, Mr. Vaccine in a lot of ways, on with Anderson Cooper on CNN. And he's saying that if we had a normal federal government, we already would have had websites saying the kind of things you're talking about, Art. But I thought the CDC made the decision. I read this thing from some advisory committee on ethical immunization practices. I assume advisory means...
They do recommendations, but I still think states can decide.
They decide,
so
okay.
There have been federal, pardon me, reports. National yeah. Academy of Medicine had an ethics guideline. There are plenty of papers out there mm-hmm. making recommendations, including some by me. And there's certainly going to be advice from the CDC, and there's going to be advice from the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, which advises the CDC. All good. But, you know, in the U.S., states kind of decide, not the federal government. That's just how we operate.
You know, if you're talking to people making decisions, can I pass on a recommendation that I'm hoping you would pass on? I would argue that the people of South Dakota should get the vaccine as soon as Governor Noem discovers one on her own. I mean, how about that? Do you believe this woman is still opposing a mask mandate as
yep.
this thing is raging crazy. Through her state? It is criminal. We're talking to Art Kaplan.
So Art Kaplan, our medical ethicist, of course, private sector getting involved here and trying to talk people into taking the vaccine.
It's great.
$50 million ad campaign, I think, proposed by the Ad Council, nonprofit
yep.
group, advertising group. Is that enough? I don't know.
Well, a $50 million ad campaign would, get them 30 seconds on this show? I mean, that's not a big sum of money.
Yeah, exactly.
So I don't think that's going to have a major impact. It's okay. I'm not against it. I everybody's worried about hesitancy and people not taking it, and you do want people to take it. Partly, we don't know yet whether we keep saying it's going to stop infectivity. That is, you could get the shot, not get sick, but still spread the virus because it's still in your body and you're still sneezing it out or coughing it out. I hope that's not true, but we don't know yet. So you might get protection from death, which is not minor, but you may not stop the spread as fast. The one vaccine, by the way, that looks to have a little more data on this is the AstraZeneca one again, which looks like they have measured some reduction in infectivity. So that's good. But this is a long-winded way of saying, I'm not sure that there really is going to be a need for these campaigns for very long, because once the vaccine goes out and doctors and nurses stop dying and people who clean rooms don't get as sick, I think people are going to say, you know what, it looks good, it seems safe, I'm going to want it, and then we're going to get into yelling and screaming about why can't I get it, why are you giving it to other people?
Yeah, but let's assume you're right, and I hope you are right. I'm not convinced you're right. Marjorie, I don't know if you even heard this, nor do I know if it's in the paper this morning. The woman who is the head of Health and Human Services here, Mary Lou Sutters, who is really competent in Massachusetts, announced yesterday that the reason that Charlie Baker is starting this Get Mass Back or whatever it is
right.
campaign, you know, to get back to where we were in the world, you have to make sacrifices along the way. I mean, that's not exactly how they framed it. She said they did a survey of 1,000 people, and 52 people were being really percent really do this is in Massachusetts being mm-hmm. really cautious about this. 48% treating it like normal times, and I'm getting the words wrong, but that's the gist of this. So I'm not as optimistic as you are. And whether you're right or not, I think we discussed this with you a month or so ago. Doesn't it make sense to have leaders in different communities that appeal to different kinds of people, whether it's in ads or PSAs or just appearing for interviews, talking to people who respect their point of view, saying, do this, trust me, I've done the research, and this is reliable and safe and necessary, no?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think you do need different spokespersons for different groups, reasons that minority folks might be skeptical or not the same as someone who may be skeptical because they didn't trust the science, because mm-hmm. they didn't trust Donald Trump. And maybe they'll become more trusting with Biden kind of coming to the running of the science, if you will, less politics, more pure science. So I do think there are at least different strokes needed for different folks in terms of messaging. I'd concede that. Still, look, here's the difference. A lot of traditional anti-vaccine work, the small number of people who hate vaccines, they always say, you don't need it because when's the last time you saw somebody with the measles, or when's the last time your kid really had the mumps? And we have outbreaks, but most people don't see them. In this pandemic, who hasn't been touched by somebody getting sick or dying or having to stay home or having someone in nursing home die that was a relative? You know, it's all around us.
Yeah.
Plus, we're all quarantined. It's a different... I don't think the traditional rules about hesitancy are going to apply. You show me a vaccine that works. You show me a vaccine that's safe, even if it makes me sick or have symptoms for a day when I get it,
right,
which some of these do. I'm still predicting people are going to start to cross over pretty quick and say, I'll take it.
Do you know, I wonder, because there's been fisticuffs and sometimes even violence involving fights over mask wearing.
Yeah.
Do you think there will be a show us your vaccine certificate before you can come to the movie theater? Or, I mean, do you think that's going to happen?
100% guaranteed, yes.
Yes.
Already started. The head of Qantas Airlines in Australia already said, we're going to have to require a vaccination certificate before you get on my plane.
Yeah, that's what I figured.
By the way, your dog just ate the lawn, the leaf blowing people next door.
It's utter bedlam and mayhem here. I got leaf blowers, dogs. The dog's going nuts because of the leaf blower.
Yeah. Oh, God, I hate those leaf blowers.
So Art, yesterday, a regular on our show is the business columnist for the Boston Globe, Shirley Leung, and every week she gives us an update on remote learning for her two kids. They're 6 and 8, Marjorie. How old are they? 6 and 9?
I don't know. They're little. They're little. Elementary school.
Right. She talked about taking one to the doctor the other day, and while he would ordinarily, because he's growing, have gained 10 pounds, the doctor said that he had gained 20 pounds. And lo and behold, we're talking to you about the fact that for kids, weight gain has been a real serious problem during the pandemic. What's going on?
Well, the kids aren't getting out. There's no organized activities. There's no sports. There's no after school program. There's no recess. So they're, home and getting sluggish, just sitting in front of screens. I hope parents try to give their kids some reason to exercise or run around if they have the possibility of going out. Not all kids live in places where that's easy to do, but it's a real problem. I think damage to their health is something that, is occurring because of this lack of physical activity. We worry about mental health, but physical health is there too. I don't know how to solve it because things are coming to winter, right? It's only going to get a little worse for most kids in who are listening to us. And it's just maybe you can make some kind of physical activity, exercise, part of their routine as they stay in.
You know, are people, before we move on, like you and the people with whom you work, while we're trying to live through this until everybody's vaccinated, or a significant percentage of us are vaccinated, is everybody already getting their plans together about how to undo the damage that has been done, whether it's to a kid's physical health, staying with kids, or we talk to the former Secretary of Education in Massachusetts all the time about what they're going to do about the growing inequality gap that's always been a problem, but now a greater problem. Is that happening in the medical world?
I don't see much of that yet. I really don't. I think it's important to begin it, but no, I really don't see it. I think people are still trying to figure out how to get you to mask and socially isolate and do the right things now. Remember, even with vaccination, we're going to have to do some of that until we establish that we're not infecting one another anyway. So I'm going to say no, not really. One other thing, by the way, we're all hepped up about vaccines, and that's great, but I hope the Biden administration gets hepped up about testing. You've had guests on, I know, that talk about the importance of doing more testing and strategic testing, and I completely agree with that. We're not doing that properly either. The fact that people are trying to go out and travel on Thanksgiving and waiting, 9 years in line before they can get a test is absurd. So the Trump administration, hooray for them, bet on vaccines and poured money in, and we luckily seem to be getting results, but we also need better testing. They work hand in hand. They help us control the pandemic, identify who's sick, get them to isolate, get them to stop spreading, and then you have a complementary thing with the vaccines. But we need a more comprehensive strategy out there, not just vaccine, vaccine, vaccine. That's nice. That's great. But testing would help us too.
We're talking to our medical ethicist, Art Kaplan. You know, people may remember, we're going to play a little sound from him in a few minutes, Sam Burns. He kind of became a bit of a media star. He was on, gave a TED Talk in 2013. Anyway, he was a young man who lived about 16 years and died from this rare disorder that causes children to age really quickly. I think it's called progeria. Yes. Let's hear a little bit about Sam, and then we're going to hear from Sam. They're going to hear about this new drug that can help some of these people. Here's Sam during a TED Talk in 2013, 2 days before his 17th birthday. So he made it to 17, talking about his diagnosis, how it does not define him.
And I'd like to say that even though I have progeria, most of my time is spent thinking about things that have nothing to do with progeria at all. Now, this doesn't mean that I ignore the negative aspects of these obstacles. When I can't do something like run a long distance or go on an intense roller coaster, you know, I know what I'm missing out on. But instead, I choose to focus on the activities that I can do through things that I'm passionate about, like scouting or music or comic books or any of my favorite Boston sports teams.
So he has passed away, as we said, in 2013, but tell us about 2014, excuse me. Tell us about this new drug and what it means.
Well, there apparently is a intervention that's just been brought forward that can slow the process of progeria, which is basically, it shows that partly aging, what happens to all of us, is partly controlled by genes. And if you could get those genes to shut off, maybe you wouldn't age as fast. I know people are thinking, well, is that going to be something that's good for all of us? So far, no. It targets particular mutations and problems that people with this very rare disease have. It's exciting. It's great because that is a horrible, horrible disease, and that person was really a brave hero. But it is exciting, and we should remember that while we're all COVID-obsessed, gene therapy, trying to use techniques that stop terrible genetic diseases like Batten's disease or hemophilia, it's still, that work is still going on, and we're seeing progress in going after some of those diseases. Many people are hopeful that we might get there with ALS, for example, another horrible killer. So across the board, as we mapped the genome and understood what genes are responsible for what various diseases like progeria, people basically are finding ways to get genes altered or changed to fix and repair genetic defects. That's what this is all about.
Two quick things before you go is, one, I remember watching this young man on television. He was so impressive and strong, and his family has stayed with this issue even 6 years after he died, and I think a great part of the reason for this progress, albeit only to extend the life of people with progeria a couple of years so far, is because they have dedicated their life's work to the memory of their son. So good for the whole family. Hey, happy Thanksgiving there, Art Kaplan. Keep it small.
Hey, we've got some light at the end of the tunnel, I think, and a new administration that's going to, I think, get this organized in a better way, the battle against COVID. So let's hang in there, and maybe January, February, we can sort of start to see our neighbors and ourselves getting access to some vaccines. So I'm just, you know, we got 3 miserable months to come, and then maybe we'll really start to see an impact on this thing.
Don't forget to pass on my South Dakota recommendation to the appropriate
people. I will
people,
do
please.
That.
Thank
I will
you.
Do that.
See you, Art.
Hey, Art, thanks a lot. Yeah.
Take care.
Bye now.
Bye-bye. Art Kaplan joins us every week. He's the Dr. William Meff from Virginia Conley Mitty Chair and Director of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU School of Medicine. Coming up, David Burns' American Utopia will return to Broadway next fall. Until then, there are other ways to have the American Utopia experience. David Byrne himself joins us for that conversation next on 89.7 GBH Boston Public Radio.